another episode of the Narratives in Philosophy podcast. On today's program, we discuss the great man theory of history, what is greatness, and discuss methodologies for the analysis of history. It's going to be a great program today, and much lively discussion has happened. Jacob and I have actually sat down and attempted to record multiple episodes, so if we seem a little bit mentally tired, that is why. But we have our coffee, which is excellent. And we have, Jacob is still on his wine from the very first glass. I've poured a second. I have Akintoshin.
It's not exactly wine. It's fortified wine.
What does it taste like? Do you have any...
It's actually very pleasant. The thing with fortified wine to me is there's always this really strong aftertaste. And I know it's alcohol related because it's a similar but differently flavored aftertaste to like a whiskey or something. You might get something strong. So,
sure.
Anyways, for that reason, I do sip it. I do drink that slowly, as we've discussed in previous episodes.
Yes, Jacob.
I don't always
lingers over his pleasures.
You could say that.
It's good.
Anyways,
so this is the Narratives in Philosophy podcast, and something I find interesting is that narratives are just kind of waiting for our finding in history.
This is true.
But something that struck me is that apparently history does not have a single narrative. History can be analyzed in multiple ways.
Yeah. What comes to mind immediately is the concept of the meta-narrative and how you can read different stories into these different meta-narratives depending on which one you actually believe is the rationale for how things go. Or you might try and not believe in any meta-narrative at all, but that's kind of intrinsically also a different meta-narrative, so...
I mean, you could maybe believe that there's values in analyses of history from multiple perspectives.
Yeah, that would work as well. And I think that that's a utilitarian approach to history.
Yeah.
The trouble is you have a grounding problem, how are you actually going to interpret something if not in a singular way? You know, how are you... And in that case, you get back to one of the things we talked about in the last episode, kind of arbitrary structures, arbitrary formulations of things that you kind of fit stuff into a mold that you built without any particular reason for that mold to be in a particular way.
You could maybe do like a Darwinian analysis of history, like, oh, here's how the human species...
And we've evolved and...
Has become better,
and
supposedly.
And to be kind of... bring the topic to the forefront here, the great man theory in a way doesn't escape this critique of it being arbitrary. It's effectively stating that we can view history through the stories of great men. And I think that's kind of a direct statement of what the great man theory asserts. Or you can greatly view history, or you can mostly view history, something along those lines.
Yeah, and that's the thing. What's interesting is the person who came up with this theory, Thomas Carlyle, said in his lecture, quote, "The history of the world, I said all right already, was the biography of great men," unquote.
Yeah, that's...
Equivocal, and I guess an unequivocal assertion. It's just history of the world equals the biography of great men. So he believes that in history, great men are the linchpins that move these things. What does that look like? Practically, in a historical perspective.
Sure. So we brought this topic to the book club when we talked about some readings from Plutarch. We talked about, I believe, Julius Caesar.
We did, yeah.
And
Alexander the Great.
And also Charlemagne, yeah. So those three individuals we studied. We read the Dual Lives of Charlemagne. Or no, that's not it, the title.
Parallel Lives.
Yeah. Parallel Lives is from Plutarch. And it studied a Roman and a...
Charlemagne's book was Someone the Stammerer.
Not according to the Stammerer, but it was two books. I have it here, hold on. It was two books that were both... Einhard, Life of Charles the Great, Life of Charlemagne. So Einhard is the proper historical account of Charlemagne. Einhard is supposedly... with Charlemagne for many of these events. He's telling things that he actually witnessed. On the other hand, Nautica the Stammerer he was a monk, the monk of St. Gall. He had no real firsthand experience of Charlemagne as far as most people are concerned, but yet the story, the biography of Charlemagne that he gives is actually somewhat compelling as well. As we discussed in the book club, I think his account is the telling of Charlemagne from a commoner's perspective, from a person in his empire. What do you think of your king? And he says a lot of really great things about Charlemagne, so that's kind of telling of what the people thought of their ruler. Whereas Einhard's telling is just more factual, it's more direct. It kind of just tells the story how it seems to be. So anyways, we read of these great men, and I brought up the idea of this great man theory of history, as it had been kind of floating around in some conversations previously, of, well, can we really, how much credit can we actually give these great men? Well, was sort of the way I approached it. And then there's ancillary questions to that. It's, are there great men in our midst? How can we find these great men? Do we want to be great men? What does it mean to approach that? All of these things kind of surround this theory as sort of secondary topics that are of great interest to us.
Because it seems today, wouldn't you say that anybody can be great from the perspective of present culture?
In a colloquial sense, absolutely. People want to say, oh, everyone's great, everyone is, has, you know, greatness in them.
They go even further if you read the New York Times, which is that it doesn't matter who you are, you can influence history, and
yeah,
they will write 20-page paper foldouts dedicated to your thing. So in what sense do you think the great man theory was formulated? What is greatness to the great man theory look like?
Yeah, I think it's influence. It is a sort of, how much did you actually change the natural flow of history? So if we look at a set of civilizations that comprise multiple nations in the world, and we see, okay, this nation has this size, you know, population or army and these sort of rulers, and they're running off of this sort of economic system, and here's the raw data, and you do that for all these different nations, what you should see in a kind of a feudal model is a sort of a system where certain countries grow and certain countries shrink according to that raw data. Well, you don't actually see that in history. You don't see that reflected at all. What you see is individuals rising to places and power over empires far, far greater than what could have been predicted from that raw data that you observed.
It's interesting. The Macedonians, to all extents and purposes, look hilarious compared to the wisdom of the Athenians, the martial might of the Spartans.
Yeah.
Who's to say the backwater to the north is going to be that which brings Hellenism to the Levant and to the Mediterranean?
Yeah. Or in the case of Charlemagne itself, you see the whole Roman Empire in the west was dissolved by barbarian invasions from the north, to just kind of say it bluntly. And then he somehow comes in, he's a regional ruler, and unites what we now know as Europe. Like, he literally creates Europe? Like, how does this just emerge from all of these different cultures and people somehow suddenly uniting under a head? Like, they were barbarians, supposedly. You know, sure, organization, civilization, all that, but barbarian invasions ruined the whole Western Roman Empire, and then, you know, 100 years later or something along those lines, Charlemagne rises up as king. You wouldn't have predicted that. And so we say, well, Charlemagne must be a great man, and history can be told as a series of biographies of these great men.
Interesting. Because, see, there's the other perspective, and this is something we see illustrated specifically in the American question. You know, not that I want to get back to talking about Europe. I think Europe is a very entertaining thing to talk about.
Yeah.
Not to be, you know, Anglo-centric or whatever, but it's just objectively entertaining to talk about. So the reframing that can happen of history, instead of telling the tale of American independence from the 1776 perspective, the founders get together, have a Congress, and write all of this down, there's another perspective. And this is called the 1619 Project. And it's something that the New York Times is doing. I'm not really commenting on it. I'm just pointing out that they're reframing history, and now we're telling the perspective of women of color, men of color, and that is the emphasis. And
yeah,
men may or may not be the emphasis. A lot of people today look at the great man theory of Carlyle and they say, why does that need to be the analysis point? And this is the question I tried to ask in the book club many moons ago, and it was hilariously received. I believe the response was, quote, "Oh no," unquote. It wasn't you who said that.
I know who said that, yeah.
It's really funny.
I do recall.
But I would like to, now that we have this time,
sure,
explore why. Why do we think that that needs to be the heuristic? Is it simply that we have to pick a heuristic, so we picked that one?
And to come from it from the perspective of a question, why is this the natural heuristic? Because when you do read at least older history books along those lines, that's what you're reading. You're reading a series of biographies about, you know, quote-unquote great men.
Yeah.
And that's what Carlyle wasn't so much as formulating a theory as he was observing what the reality was. So,
what it seems.
The question here is, why is this a good heuristic, or why is this used typically as a heuristic by historians, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Why is it the heuristic, and is there something inherently wrong with that heuristic, or is there no... There might even be no reason to say that it's inherently wrong to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But today, what we're saying is, oh, racism, inequity...
I'm sure there have been rhetorical attacks levied against this quote-unquote great man theory of history, even if just for the name great man theory.
Yeah, just the name.
And we commented in the book club, you could call it the great people theory, the great person theory.
Yeah.
To be accurate.
So there's nothing necessarily connected to the sex of the person.
I don't think so, no. Again, I think Carlyle was observing, and he's using language in an older way. I mean, when it's a thing. Like, you say man, you mean mankind. Sure, it's gendering, but at the same time, that's coming from this kind of Western Christian perspective that man was created and from man came woman. Like, it's intrinsic in the very word woman. From man, you know? So, anyways, it's a use of the word, like...
In the old style.
I'm not going to get caught up on it. I'm also not going to defend it. You could say great person theory of history. It's fine.
And I'm by no means arguing for or against anything here. I just want to figure out what's the rationale, if there is any. Something that is interesting to me is you could take many different points of view of history. You could say history is the working of men who have this divine imbuement. One of the things that Carlyle said in his essay was that great men have this spirituality about them. This almost Christological way of doing things.
Yeah.
That leads
that
me
is
to
interesting.
Believe that there, to some extent, must be an emphasis on the great man theory of history, not just being a great person of history from Carlyle's perspective. Even though that is what we said, and I think that that's fair.
Yeah.
I think that's a fair thing. Great person.
So his theory kind of went beyond that.
It goes beyond that and says, you know, men are the people who move the framework of society. And if you don't like that, facts don't care about your feelings. To quote the ongoing motif of our discussions off the record.
Yeah.
That's what I seem to get. He talks about Odin first.
Right.
And he says Odin was based on, and this is probably, I don't know where he got this, but he claimed Odin was based on a real person.
Mm-hmm.
And they believed that Odin was a god.
Yeah.
Because Odin did these things. He invented poetry, and he invented language.
Yeah.
They call him a god for doing that. Then he talks about Muhammad
mm-hmm.
in the second lecture.
Yeah.
And he talks about how Muhammad is this amazing prophet who's living in some sort of spiritual walk. So every great man he talks about has this religious connotation.
That's true.
I thought that was interesting.
Is interesting.
What does that mean?
It goes back to what we talked about with your narrative framework. Especially when you first formulated it, you considered to almost have this kind of religious meta-narrative quality to it. Of you can be a great man if you go through that framework of, you know, problem stated, solution proposed, final fulfillment.
Yeah.
If you use that sort of rhetoric, you know, great man in his words, like there's a post and positive perspectives that delineates this a bit more. If you go through that framework, this is what great men do. And I think you're right. Both that framework and men employing it certainly has that religious meta-narrative connotation to it, just implicitly.
Yeah, and that gets us to really one of the big cruxes. If we can assent to Carlyle's view for a minute that men are the ones, and I would love us to maybe unpack that. You know, it would be super incendiary. People would probably hate us for talking about it because the question would be, are men the linchpins in history? So far, they seem to have been.
I mean, you definitely could point out examples where women were linchpins. And absolutely, you can have great women in history, too.
Absolutely. They're both created in the image of God.
So
I agree with that. But, then the second
what
thing
were you referring to exactly?
Are great people born? Or is it the tools they use?
Yeah, that's the crux of the conversation, yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a couple of perspectives here. That you could call it like a great circumstance of history sort of theory. You could also say another interesting comment here is that history is written by the victors. And so this is to say that those strong, great, you know, quote-unquote great, in this case, men, were simply the most dominating of the forces and thereby wrote about their great works and deeds.
And even if what they did wasn't good, they retroactively wrote their history
as a great thing,
in a way
yeah.
that put it in that master narrative structure.
Yeah,
The
history is written by the victors. I mean, there's certainly some merit to it. What I counter with is, for instance, with Charlemagne, we have two differing accounts. One from Nautiker the Stammerer, the monk of St. Gall, who seems to be a normal person, seems to not have any real direct or at least prolonged influence or interaction with Charlemagne, and yet he thought very highly of Charlemagne. Why is that? Well, was it the narrative that Charlemagne put out about himself, or was it the deeds that Charlemagne did? You know, what exactly was going on there? But then you also have Einhard, who tells of the deeds of Charlemagne. And to me, Einhard explains Nautiker the Stammerer, because through the actual deeds of Charlemagne, as recorded by Einhard, you see how a person in his empire would be inspired, would think well, would tell these other, perhaps fanciful and fictional stories of Charlemagne.
So there was nothing that of the circumstances of the time that required Charlemagne to be who he was. Charlemagne was who he was, and so, that was amazing.
So there's two things there.
Yeah.
The first thing is me kind of rebutting the whole idea that history is written by the victors. History is written by people who, sure, they're alive. I get that. You know, they're in a particular person's kingdom.
They were not killed.
They made it. You know, that's important. As Jonathan harped on in the book club, it's important that they stayed alive.
Yeah,
but at the same time, it was a number of different accounts from a number of different people, not necessarily the victor himself. You know, victor, sure, it's plural. It includes those people. But at the same, like, from, you know, we do get history from the perspective of the winners as the good guys, because that's natural. But we also get the telling of the actual accounts, and we get the feelings from individuals that went through those, or that heard about those, in the case of the Charlemagne
and
Nautiker.
Inspired.
And so I think, you know, even if history is written by the victors, they were victors for a reason. And then beyond that, it's from a plethora of sources. It's not just from one biased source, as that quote is often used to, you know, attack with. So that's part of it.
You think it is more the circumstance than it is?
No, so I haven't addressed that at all yet.
Okay, because Thomas Carlyle has this hilarious quote. This is not a direct quote, this is a paraphrase. He says, "One reads history and expects the time to call forth these great men when they are needed. And one readily thinks of many times where the time loudly cried."
Yeah.
"And no one was to be found."
I think that's apt, yeah.
And that was pretty funny to me. I was like, yeah, the time doesn't really have much of an effect. They will rise up sometimes for no reason. They'll be there.
So for those who say that, you know, oh, it's the circumstance that made this person arise, he's directly countering. He's saying, no, when you read history, even if you want to say that the circumstance calls out, it equally calls out in many, many other times, and nobody came to that call.
Exactly, like at the fall of the Roman Empire.
Whereas it seems like they could, you know.
No great man to stand up and unify Rome in its death throes. There was no great woman. There was no great anybody. It was just disaster.
Yeah.
And Rome fell. Interesting. So then what of the time? What is our rebuttal to that?
Well, it's the same answer, right? It's circumstance, it's the time. I mean, what do you mean
circumstances
exactly?
Circumstances don't determine it at all. To what extent do
you? Oh, I see. What extent? Yeah.
I mean, it's not the time creating them, but they have to have some effect. I guess more of a, from the perspective of the person who might enter into their circumstances, what is their attitude towards the circumstances?
At least from my reading of it, the great man theory, and I think I agree with this, actually doesn't care about the time. I think what it cares about is the great man exclusively. Mm-hmm. So what we would see here is take an Alexander, and let's do the thought experiment where we pick him up, we put him in a different culture, we put him somewhere else some different time.
In New York.
It's an absurd thought experiment. What happens? What does he become? I was thinking ancient China for a different feel, but
okay.
You know, New York is equally fun to think about in the modern day. Is he
a
savvy businessman shark who is, I don't know, greater than Trump in his domination, or what is it exactly? I don't know, but
he's arrested for raping and pillaging land.
I mean, there you go. Perhaps the cultural and societal norms would have prevailed upon him, but regardless.
Interesting. So, to some extent, culture and society seem to influence this.
I think it's influence, but what the great man theory is really honing in on is saying that there's always opportunity to do great, big, massive things, and there's only specific individuals who actually take up on that opportunity. So no matter what setting, what culture, if they're really great men, then they will do largely influential things in those directions that they're given to.
I see. And they will navigate their culture and their time.
I think so,
because
yeah.
They're great.
And there's no real reason to say that, you know, to expect a 4th century European to behave like a 4th century European in a modern setting. Like, they would be raised in the modern setting, they would be cultured in the same way. It's just that there's something within them that is
greatness.
Substantially persuasive towards their actions to the extent that they legitimately influence large swaths of humanity.
I think it's obvious that I put forward a kind of after your presentation. Your presentation really got me thinking when you gave it back in 2019, and then I wrote a post when we discussed Nietzsche about what I thought great men did. But I'm curious what you thought. I don't know if you ever presented a bulleted list or a presentation on what you think these great men look like.
It was a little bit beyond the scope of my presentation. I think you approached something very interesting when you came with the great man and his words post. And I've reread that since, and I think there's some interesting merit there. I think that the narrative framework that arose from that is very interesting and certainly a powerful tool for rhetoric. Because what you're trying to ask is, how did they actually influence people?
Yeah.
In the context of the presentation I gave, I really wanted to stick to the question of, well, let's consider, can influence be quantified at all? And if so, you know, let's consider what that means for men in general.
Did you use
men.
A Pareto distribution?
I use a Zipfian distribution.
Zipfian?
Yeah.
I don't know where Pareto, what even is that word?
Pareto, it's slightly different, but yeah, they're actually in the same family of distributions,
so
to
tell,
be fair.
So tell us about this Zipfian distribution. What was the idea there?
Yeah, and like I said, in that book club, I pretty much just talked about what I wanted to talk about, even though there were sort of other questions that were begged.
Quantifying.
Yeah.
It's all how you view history. Like, we can view history any number of ways. You could say history is the history of the absurd. History is the story of man's and woman's acquisition of rights. You could say that it's the history of the playing out of passionate allegory.
Yeah.
That was just a term that came to mind. So there's any number of ways we can look at it. This is maybe the mathematical way.
Sure.
Of looking at it.
So I said, imagine you can quantify influence. I wonder if the great man theory couldn't be extended upon to show that there is a distribution of influence among people. And this distribution could
look like a Zipfian distribution, since Zipfian is the distribution of how commonly words are employed. So what a Zipfian distribution is, very simply, is that the most common item is twice as common as the second most common item, which is twice as common as the third most common item, and down you go. No, that's actually not quite right. The third most common item is a third as common as the first one. So it's one over. It's one over n, where n is the position of the item.
So rarer as it goes down.
Yes. The first item is the most common. It has half the usages. And so in any given language, words fit fairly well into this distribution. In English, the is the most common word, and it is used twice as commonly as the second most common word, which I think is a.
True.
Which is used, you know, you follow the Zipfian distribution down, you find all these other words all the way down in the distribution, and it works for any language, apparently. So it's kind of this, or even in large books and if you were to take, say, the dictionary, not the dictionary, the, that's a terrible example. Well, it might work. I wonder how that would work, actually, because there's definitions in dictionaries.
What would happen there? Words, Zipfian distribution, you go on down, it gets rarer deeper you go.
So the thought was, well, what if men fit into this distribution as well? If you can quantify distribution, then the most influential man will be twice as influential as the next most influential man.
Hmm.
And the third most influential will be a third as influential as the most influential man, and so on and so forth. And so I wondered if this could work. I don't know. I ran some quick, I wrote a computer program that calculated the distribution based on a population of 10 billion individuals throughout the history of the world.
You wrote a computer program to help us quantify the great man theory. This is amazing.
To provide some rough numbers, yes.
This is good. Now, this is almost like giving us, rough divisions of value here to figure out how this works. Do you have this? Can you pull this up?
The program, maybe not. I might have a post on it. Let's see, real quick. Yeah, I don't see the post. That doesn't mean it's not good.
Either way, it's amazing. You built something to help us figure this out.
I remember one of the numbers, at least. The top 1% of the population has 80% of the influence. I think that was right, or it might have been 10% has 80%. Regardless, you followed this distribution down, you had a 0.00-whatever percent of individuals, and they still had a large percentage of the influence.
So it's possible that a group of 100 people have the most power.
Yeah, the 100 most influential people in the world have a ton of influence relative to everyone else. That's how these sort of distributions work.
Is there any way in the present to figure out who those people are in their time? And is influence necessarily greatness?
Yeah. So I equivocated influence with greatness because I don't know how else to quantify. I mean, greatness isn't so much a noun as it is an adjective in a way.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great work. And so I said, well, Carlyle probably really means a great amount of influence over the course of history, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about history.
Yeah.
So anyways, as we talked in the book club, we said, well, imagine the greatest man in history, perhaps the greatest is Jesus himself.
Yeah.
That would mean he has, a massive amount of influence. The next most influential person, I don't know who you would name, but, a Gandhi or a Muhammad or, some other large religious leader, perhaps.
Yeah, so there's really no way to apply this in the present day. This needs to really be quantified in historical terms.
In terms of a Zipfian distribution, you absolutely can apply it to any population at any time. It's actually a bit of a fractal evaluation, which I think is apt. In the current day, sure, there could be a Zipfian distribution to the amount of influence per person as well. The most influential person could have, twice as much influence as the second most influential, and the three times as much as the third most influential, and on you go down the Zipfian distribution. That certainly could be true. It's just not provable because we have yet to quantify what influence is in the first place.
So, this is one thing that makes it a really interesting effect here. This is all a very human-centric way of looking at history.
Yeah.
for a long time, and I've actually heard history taught this way growing up.
Absolutely.
People would look at history and say, history is the story of the providential acts of God.
Mm.
So when you're studying history, you're studying the story of God's providential acts.
Yeah.
That I take issue with, I feel uncomfortable with.
Mm.
I'm not quite sure why.
Well, we've talked...
It's 6 million dead Jews. I mean, that kind of feels...
Yeah, really.
That kind of feels painful to look at that and say, oh, providential acts of God.
We've talked about Molinism on this podcast before, right?
Yeah.
So, if we go back to that framework, I think that probably solves the discomfort that you have with that idea.
Within time.
Yeah.
So we need to study the men and the women.
We do, because there is free will associated with them. There's genuine libertarian free will associated with them.
That's fair.
And if that's the case, then, you know, you do have a sort of... a situation where... The story of God thing, while it might be true on a meta-narrative level, is not true on actions of humans level. It's not as if the actions of humans equate to the actions of God. They legitimately don't.
I appreciate that, because it's tough to get around the fact. I mean, that might have worked in the medieval time period, but when you're looking at the disastrous 20th century or the actions of colonialism in the 19th century, it's tough to make that play.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. So greatness. Greatness is influence. And influence is what? What is influence? The ability to change people, change events, change institutions?
I sketched it at the beginning of this episode by saying it's changing the natural flow of history. So if you view all the data, like I explained, you can come to a sort of mathematical conclusion about what would happen. What I'm proposing here is that influence is the amount of change from the model that is... It's a theoretical model. It's not something that we can actually do, because you can never actually account for all of the data, or else you'd have a really... it's a very difficult model to build. I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm saying it's beyond our current capabilities.
Sure.
But regardless, imagine that there were a perfect model that took the input of the current state of the world, did not consider... the, let's say, differing dispositions of different people and predicted an outcome, then the amount of change from that outcome that an individual caused is the amount of influence that they have.
Oh, wow. And see, this is what's so difficult when people are like, okay, I want to change my world. I want to be great right now.
Mm-hmm.
This methodology only seems to work in the past. Like, you have to be looking backwards, and you have no way of knowing
yeah.
the actions you're doing at that time are commensurate with greatness.
It's an interesting point.
Or influence.
That is a very interesting
point.
Sort of
heuristic
yeah.
for figuring that out, because
well,
you can't
is...
just say, do what Alexander the Great did.
Yeah, no, this is certainly one of the most pertinent and interesting kind of side questions to the great man theory of history. Like, just to delineate, can we identify current great men? Like, that is actually a problem in and of itself. We don't know who is actually having massive influence. Look at it in terms of music, composers,
yeah.
right?
Sure.
The classic case for Mozart's music and Beethoven's music and whoever else wasn't necessarily well-received in their own day.
Yeah.
And yet their actual overall influence on musical history
massive.
Turned out to be immense.
Oh, yeah.
And so we do have this problem of, I think the answer really, really legitimately is no. We have no idea who's actually causing influence, because we don't know their long-term reception of their ideas. Maybe there is an equally persuasive individual who comes around right after them and brings that course of history right back to the predicted model. So then we have to account for our... I've just realized my explanation is perhaps lacking a bit, because not only is it change from the model, it's continuous change from the model, and you have to update the model continuously as well. So then the measurement would be weird, because once someone has caused change, they would have to perhaps continue causing change. Yeah, it kind of breaks down when you think about it in a continuous way.
So, here's a question.
maybe highlights the difficulty of identification. But anyways, go on.
Greatness, influence, action. These are the three things that come to mind. You know, there's lots of things we can get into about narrative structure and what I put forward later, but the first question that might put us that way is it possible that someone could influence the course of history and change countless lives and be a person of great effect and considered so hundreds upon hundreds of years after their birth and death without speaking a single word? And this is just a thought experiment that I would like to undergo. The way we are as humans, do we think that would be possible? And if so, what might that look like? Could they be great, quote unquote great, exhibit greatness without speaking a single word?
Huh.
Like Charlemagne,
would
he have been able to do what he did? Unify his position in Europe? Would Alexander the Great have been able to lead his army? Because, you know, there's that classic Francis of Assisi, you know, always be preaching, and if so, use words.
Yeah, when necessary, use words. And there's also, you know, the whole actions speak louder than words sort of phrase that's floated around. It's a weird question because I think on a practical case, the answer is automatically no, it's not possible. But at the same time, you're asking it as a thought experiment, so you don't necessarily have to consider the practicality.
On a practical level, no. And the thought experiment level is, what would it look like if it were to happen? And that's something I was trying to think about the other day.
Yeah. Okay, so by words, you probably mean communication of any linguistic sort.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, sign language, for instance, would be off the table.
Sign language would be off the table. Words would be off the table.
Yeah.
Waving your hands around, off the table.
So what really constitutes a linguistic communication, then, is where I go. Because, you know, we could say the very act of body language is, in a sense, communication. You know, I'm sitting here in a particular way, I'm gesturing, maybe I'm, you know, messing with my hair. I'm saying things to you without saying anything to you.
True.
So does that count as well? And if we go down this road, we're going to restrict that individual down to a vegetative state of nothingness. And I don't think that someone who laid in their bed unconscious for their entire life could be a great person. No.
Oof. Now see, that gets interesting because now you get into value as well as greatness, but that's a sundry topic. Okay, well, let's pick a place to draw the line. And since we're drawing lines, we might as well say verbal communication and certain codified nonverbal communication. So, you know, the way a guy sits there is okay. The way a guy moves his sword arm when he's leading the army doesn't matter. But he's not allowed to speak. So what does he do?
The only thing that comes up to mind as a perhaps touch point for where we can work through this is a sort of Spartan-like environment where you have individuals who are raised for the specific purpose of being Spartans and epic warriors and all of that. I can at least vaguely imagine an individual in that sort of society raised up and becomes a great Spartan and is, you know, inspirationally incredible when it comes to fighting and thereby causes a significant amount of influence. But that is such an extreme. The thing is, I think he would be rejected by any society if he didn't use words. That's if you, like, imagine a guy running around all the time. Or imagine a guy, you know, without a tongue, but then he also doesn't write anything down, and he doesn't use the sign language that, you know, like, it's just, he would be rejected, you know? I mean, I hate to say it, but, like, especially the Spartans would have left him out to the dogs a long time ago.
Hyper-stoicism. You've heard of hyper-Calvinism. Hyper-stoicism. Okay, alright, that's good. Okay, well, I know where we both feel there, so we agree to some extent that words are necessary.
Yeah.
So...
to some extent. Jeez, dude. Just a little bit
the
necessary.
The understatement of the century.
All right,
so words are a necessitude. So then the question would be, Is it the words themselves? Or is it something else? What is it that is being hit upon when a great man is becoming great? And, you know, I'll just come right out and say it. I think that the method that I laid down for a man to become great was his words. And of course, to some extent, he has to have the time opening itself to him. If he has no platform, can he really be great? Can he create himself a platform? This has been big nihilism for me.
Yeah.
Like,
I think there is an aspect of creating your platform. You don't get anywhere by running that status quo.
Yeah.
You just don't. If there is a...
Show up to your corporate office and, you know, stand up on your cubicle and start preaching, or maybe you do. I mean, this is how the 1917 revolution happened in Russia.
Maybe you do. There's not a paved road that leads to greatness. I'll put it like that. You pave your own road on that way to greatness. And if you follow the paved road, what I'm saying, at least, is that you have not swayed the course of history in an interesting way. Maybe you do have a history book written about you. Oh, you were the ruler of this great nation at this great time. But at the same time, if you were the son of the ruler before that and followed the paved road to become that ruler, it's really your dad or his dad or whoever, you know, initially set those events in motion,
so
who has
room,
all of the greatness.
No room for the conservatives and the reactionaries at the table of greatness.
Yeah, not for influencing the course of history in the way the great man theory proposes.
So they have to be iconoclastic and do something that breaks the mold? I mean, that's interesting, because what if the mold has become breaking the mold, and now all of a sudden your reactionary conservatism is weird and new?
Well, you know, roles get reversed in that case. It's not hard to see. You know, you do have a bit of a linguistic difficulty there when progressivism is what I was going to say, is the norm. You know, you have a linguistic difficulty with saying, okay, suddenly being conservative is actually being progressive in the way that you're moving, you know, you're actively changing something. You're moving back to a different norm. You know, you are paving a road in that case.
Yeah, I'll pick something just so people know we're not, like, you know, picking reactionary in the term that we think fascism is great. Let me clarify that. Instead, think of it this way. I'm reactionary in the sense that I don't like the Industrial Revolution, and this is not me saying this, but perhaps I don't like the Industrial Revolution. I think we need to go back to subsistence farming.
Mm.
That could be seen as progressive from a certain perspective, because now you're like, oh, sustainability.
Wasn't
we
that
saved
Jefferson?
The planet.
If I recall, wasn't that a Thomas Jefferson thing? Wasn't that actually a view?
It might have been. I mean, I think he thought land ownership was a very important thing, you know, just like the Roman farmer.
Anyway,
so this is good.
Not a history podcast.
We go back to it, and there might not be a paved road, but is there a paved toolkit? We know at the very least it looks something like words have to be part of it.
Okay, so what you're getting at now is there any idea how great men become great? Is that right?
Perchance, yes.
I like this road of reasoning.
This train of thought.
Words certainly are mentally important in this. And I am all but ready to jump on the bandwagon of the narrative structure as being a core component in our rhetorical toolkit in order to become great men. Because when it comes down to it, narrative, as we believe here on Narratives and Philosophy, is I'm just going to come out and say it. It's the most influential rhetorical device that's ever been. And when we construct something like the narrative framework, where you can fit, as we've discussed, anything into this framework and make it and pull the reason, pull the motifs and the underlying causes out from it, like, you have such a powerful bulldozer at your disposal.
I mean,
at that point,
there's a narrative framework for every newspaper, you know, for the New York Times, problem stated, we have not achieved equal acquisition of rights in every way, not even under the law, to some extent. And the solution proposed is activism and electing the right people to office. Now, you hear the quote from Ocasio-Cortez, "The what matters is not your age, but the age of your ideas." And the final fulfillment is a world where everyone, and that's the interesting thing about that particular narrative. And one of my students asked this question the other day, because I had them do civil rights presentations, and he said, "The people who fight for equal rights, how will they know when they're done?" And I was like, amazing question.
Yeah.
Because how will they know when they're done?
Right.
There's nothing to put in that final fulfillment category except everyone being treated fairly. Well, that has never existed, and I've had other students
it's
who
it's not
admitted,
what to find either.
Yeah. Because I told them, does treating everyone fairly mean I treat everyone exactly the same? Because I could just say, you're all equally worthless, and I'm going to treat you all like crap.
Or, you know, in the case of a prisoner in federal prison and they've committed several felonies, do you treat them the same? No, you don't. You keep them in prison. You know, that they have a judgment put upon them. You can't actually treat them the same legally. Like, it's a flawed premise.
So, that's an interesting thing about that, is that sometimes things don't fit into the framework. It's not that they don't propose something for the final fulfillment. It's just that the final fulfillment is
bad.
Hazy?
Bad.
It's not quite sure what it exactly means.
Let me get at this, though, because I've used the narrative framework some now, and I've used it to critique books, to critique works.
Oh, yeah.
Thoughts, ideas. And the way this works is that you try and identify the problem stated that they state.
Yeah.
And if you can find that their problem stated is not a real problem based on, you know, we'll just say evidence here.
Yeah.
If their problem is literally not real, if we say the problem is the great spaghetti monster in the sky is killing people.
Or they say their problem is, you know, the shark amount off the coasts of Australia. And like, okay, yeah, that's a problem for the ecosystem. But
yeah.
Is that a problem for the
But are we going
human
to
race?
Spend billions of dollars to solve this, you know?
Yeah.
Anyways, you go through this. You find the problem stated. Okay, there can be problems with the problem stated. Like, it can actually be a bad problem or an insufficient problem.
To matter.
Or a fake problem. And then you find their solution proposed.
Hmm.
And you evaluate. Okay, does this solution
fit the problem they say they're fighting?
Does it fit it? Does it adequately address it? To what extent does it seem like it will fix it? And then you read their solution proposed. And is it congruent to their problem stated and their solution?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You can figure out pretty quickly how disingenuous people are.
It's almost a logical check. You put whoever's story into this framework and you evaluate those three components. And if there's problems with any of the three components, you've found flaws in their reasoning.
Yeah, absolutely.
So just to harp on that, I've used this for books. I've used this for, you know, authors' ideas. And the stuff I've read, some of it, it fails on one or more of these things.
What
and
are some
therefore,
examples? Like, what are some things you've read that have just been like, here's his problem, here's his solution?
Yeah.
And his final fulfillment maybe wasn't even mentioned? What
yeah.
Were some things?
I won't quite name names, but the specific one that comes to mind, or one of the specifics that comes to mind, they proposed a problem with the church in the West that it effectively said we are spiritually dead and not responsive to the spirit moving, and they were a very, we'll say, Pentecostal individual, and they thought that the church in the West had rejected the Holy Spirit. And simply put, I have sufficient reason and evidence to not believe that. I do not believe that their problem stated is accurate. It's not an accurate picture of reality.
Hmm.
And then they go on to their solution proposed, and they propose this wide range of different things. And it was neither a clear enough solution, like it wasn't a... I couldn't clearly define their solution proposed from the whole book. This was a 200-page book. And somehow I couldn't find their actual core of their solution proposed. I found this wide range of ideas that maybe could constitute solutions.
And then the final fulfillment is like not even a thing.
Their final fulfillment is like the eternal state. Like it's perfection and holiness and awesomeness. And I'm just like, dude.
Massive logical gap.
Like, first of all, we're here on Earth.
we should solve earthly problems while we're here on Earth. Like, we're not going to jump to the afterlife. Like, what are you really asking? Like, what are you doing here? So anyways,
that's good.
He had problems with all three, and that's what comes to mind.
Now see, that's an example that's really good, and sometimes what'll happen is I've noticed the final fulfillments, like your example, don't fit any sort of
it's
reality.
Not feasible, yeah.
Like, your final fulfillment is utopia. Perfection.
Yeah, literally, yeah. When you read Utopia, that's what happens. Thomas More, thank you.
Your final
like, we're not going to get there.
Sorry, it's just not going to happen. Okay, so that's good. So see, that's the thing, is this can be used for analysis. This can also be kind of applied to religious creeds.
Well, what,
it.
What
like
we were talking about is employing it as a tool, a rhetorical tool, to become a great man. That's
and
what
that,
we were talking about.
That's the thing that scares me the most, because what I realized about this tool is this is almost like the meta structure of redemptive history. And redemptive history is meant to resonate with the human soul.
Absolutely.
So because redemptive history is meant to resonate, it's possible to take that and use it for yourself and, you know, harness it. And this was a big moral question I asked this. This moral question probably wouldn't matter to a lot of people unless you're coming from the circles that we ran with. But because you were from the circles we ran with growing up, it's a real moral quandary to sit there and think and know that when I give a speech to a crowd of people at a political stump gathering, I am using the framework or the code of the Matrix.
Yeah.
And then the moral quandary that comes to mind is this okay? Or should I just be getting up here and preaching the gospel? So there's another question beyond that, is that should we live in the physical world? To what extent should we be in
where,
the world?
Where did you just go? I don't.
Because there's a deeper question below that. This moral quandary wouldn't exist at all if there wasn't a doubt as to how much we should live in the physical world. Like, is it okay to become politicians? Is it okay to become generals? Is it okay to become these powerful men of state?
Okay, I can at least vaguely follow you there. I feel like that was a bit of a non sequitur.
It is quite there, but we're talking in non sequitur things now that are kind of in the air.
All right.
Pie in the sky.
Sure.
Pie in the sky things. So, is it morally permissible?
To employ
this thing that is literally the foundation.
That is a good question. This is also a question that did arise in that book club, if I recall.
It did. And that's the thing. Is it possible to even not use it? Because we use it, as Jonathan said.
Yeah.
I use this to sell televisions.
Absolutely.
Your problem is you do not have a TLC 52-inch TV, brother.
That's kind of where I was going to go. We're intrinsically going to use it, number one. And number two, I don't think it's a problem. What I do think is that God tells the story, the meta-narrative of history, in these terms. And because of that, as we've acknowledged before, from the Christian standpoint, the Imago Dei, being made in this image of God, means that we are meant to image him. We are meant to bear his image. And part of what that might look like is acknowledging this story and retelling our own stories in that same framework.
Hmm.
And yeah, maybe it is selling TVs or whatever it might be. I don't think there's a way around it. I think it's amoral. I don't think it's immoral.
Well, it's a powerful self-analysis tool, and that's something that I've
also often done.
What is in my mind, if I'm truly honest to myself, what is my life's chief problem? Is my life's chief problem a lack of monetary resources? Is my life's chief problem feeling tired and needing to go to Barnes & Noble and get a health book to become less tired? Is my life's chief problem that I can't seem to get along with my wife? What's so funny is about people forget that all of life seems to structure itself around these problems, and then people do all these things to try to solve them. That's why the self-help section is so massive, because life can be structured around these questions and problems and things like that.
I don't know why it didn't occur to us in the last episode. This is a heuristic framework on its surface.
Really?
Yeah, it fits all the description of the thing that we're railing against when it came to Hume and his heuristic framework.
The difference between Hume and this...
And I was trying to... Yeah, I was just trying
Hume
to find a grounding.
Arbitrarily just says, you have this, I look everywhere and cannot unsee this.
Well,
every
Hume might have felt the same way.
Problem.
He might have felt the same way about humans, though, to play devil's advocate.
He may have too, but look at his structure. There are so many wings to it. The beauty in this is that it's very, very, very simple, and the breadth of application is so massive that it feels ridiculous to deny it. Hume, I don't feel ridiculous denying the amount of passions that I have.
All right, follow me here.
Okay.
Remember in the last episode I had two conditions for can a framework fulfill? One of them was, is it philosophically grounded? And this might be, but we're actually going to skip over that one. I think the second one is actually more interesting for this. Is it...
verifiable.
Does its breadth accurately encompass the field of study?
I think meta-narrative does that.
Well, I think it does. I think here's the second thing. We were also talking about language. We talked a lot about language at the end of that episode and how it maybe is a... something that fulfills that second requirement.
Sure.
But we couldn't quite get there. What I'm thinking now is that this tool is the bridge to bring language into that place that fulfills the breadth of reasoning. This tool is a fully representative framework for meaning.
Interesting.
And people have said this about narrative all the time. Oh, narrative is the tool that you know, conveys meaning. Narrative is the true way of, you know, I don't know, telling people anything, to teach, to do anything. This tool is a representation of narrative, and thereby it does fulfill the whole scope of the subject matter of language.
Now because you can have narratives that get plugged in non-metally
but this is
on a non-meta level. But
yeah.
The meta thing itself, before variables are plugged in,
right.
What you're saying.
That's exactly it. So this framework, this exact framework, because it accurately describes the fullness of narratives in a generic sense, fulfills my requirement for a heuristic that, I forget how exactly I said it, but basically that it accurately describes the scope of the problem. So that's actually super cool.
I can actually see that now that you say that. I think I was getting confused at first because I thought it had to have variables plugged in, because obviously, as we've already done, analytically, people can plug in variables in a ridiculous way.
Yeah.
But they're still unable to not use.
I mean, they're still telling a narrative and telling a story. It's just that it's not a story that aligns with reality. And that's kind of what I was trying to get at.
And what's interesting here, going back to the man who doesn't use words, let's say you have the guy who doesn't speak. They don't need to have words written down because their words might mean nothing. But when they take this meta structure and analyze their actions, they can probably tell, oh, my life is aimed at the solving of this problem. You know, maybe stress. So at the end of the day, they come home, they pour themselves a beer, they sit down and they watch TV. That is their problem, that's their solution, and they experience their final fulfillment right then and there. So you can use this as a great moral tool to analyze your being, your very existence. So that's something I would like to do right now, is analyze my own self. And if you're wanting to do that, I'll do it. So, a problem for me. Oftentimes, I've spent a lot of time thinking about going back to school. And problem stated, my family is growing too quickly and is too big. The classic example of the Empire of Trajan. Overextension of resources. So that's a perceived problem.
Yeah.
Solution, have less children.
Okay.
Don't grow your family. Final fulfillment, more time to do what I want to do. So right away I can look at that, I've analyzed it,
sounds
and say,
nice.
Not good. So this entire course of thought, needs to be struck.
And just
from
delineate them. Why it's not a good course.
Because it's all about me. And I get to the end of it, and I can become a stronger man, or I can become a more self-centered. And this is one of the things I analyzed over the COVID crisis. It's like, okay, I have this problem with having more kids. Should I feel this way? Because I know that the ideal state is, you know, what it says. Fill your quiver full.
Yeah.
What it says. So that supposedly is real. Well, let's analyze it from my perspective. Why would I not do that? And it wasn't, you know, oh, I don't feel called to have more kids because I have these great things that God has me to do. It was, I would like more time for myself.
It was, yeah. I want to go in the garage and smoke a cigar and
exactly.
Kick back and study philosophy.
Yeah, so final fulfillment, not good enough. So another thing that I can do is I can look at it and say, okay, I'm getting up, and what am I thinking about most mornings? Most mornings, what I'm thinking about on the way to work is, I'm specifically turning on the music and blaring everything out so I don't have to think.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So I turn on the 92.5,
yeah.
I don't have to think about it, and then I go in on autopilot.
Yeah.
And I just do the bare minimum. So.
And you have a pretty long commute, right?
30 minutes, yeah.
Yeah.
So problem stated.
Too bad.
You're kind of nervous about work. Solution proposed, don't think about it. Final fulfillment, you just kind of get through.
Yeah.
Hopefully. That's probably not good. What should I do? Problem stated, I'm anxious about work. Solution proposed, the prescribed method we've been given to deal with anxiety, final fulfillment, peace which passes understanding. So, that's an example of things I could analyze in my
life.
Yeah,
those are really, really strong.
If you want to analyze something, feel free. But
well,
we can talk about it now if you want.
I was getting the thought that, you know, you could analyze your overall, you know, life,
direction.
Whole life level,
yeah.
Goals as well. You know, this could be problem stated of, I don't know, trying to find some meaning with existence, something like that. The problem stated, there's no obvious meaning in my existence. You know, solution proposed, I won't necessarily draw it out too much, but, you know, fill in the blank with religion or something like that.
Yeah.
And genuinely speaking, you should fill in the blank with whatever you consider to be that thing which provides you the most meaning. That's your answer. And so for some individuals, this might be fairly dimsel, as in online gaming communities or something along those lines, where it's very temporal, it's going to fade away. You're not going to be good at games at some point in your life, and that will go away. And so then, you know, you're going to be that age, and you're not going to have that anymore. You're not going to have meaning anymore. That's a problem.
That was me, yeah. Problem stated, severe lack of direction and too much free time.
Yeah.
And wanting to do something. So, solution proposed, enjoy these stories in the PlayStation and all these things that are, you know, in front of you, that you can enjoy and interact with.
And I've already kind of described that final fulfillment.
And final fulfillment is just at the end of the day. I mean, you look back and you're like, oh, I had a good time. You know, I had fun.
It's not a particularly final fulfillment, though. And so in an analysis tool, you look at that, you say, well, this is not final. That's
not
a
final
problem.
Enough, for sure.
You know, that is a problem with one of those previous steps to get you to that wrong final fulfillment.
That's the cool thing about it, is you can analyze creeds, philosophies, actions in your moral existence, uses of time from a utilitarian perspective.
Yeah.
And it's funny because it's so a priori and obvious that, you know, some people are like, oh, whatever, yeah, duh. I'm like, no, not duh, because do you use this?
This is so practical and so philosophically grounded.
Like, do you use this in your life is the question I would ask them.
Yeah,
like,
I don't think anyone here is saying duh, exactly.
Oh, no, not in our club. Not in our club. Nobody in our club, to my knowledge, has said duh. But, you know, out in the world, you talk to a salesman, and they're like, yeah, of course. No kidding. The problem is that you're not,
they're not reflective about it.
Hilti construction tools. The solution is Hilti construction tools. What's the final fulfillment? You're going to do your job quicker. You're going to do your job with more quality work, You're not going to have breakdowns.
Yeah.
Whatever it is that they say. So we've really used it a lot and probably beaten the point home too much, but it's really exciting.
Yeah.
Because it's my own idea.
Well, it's exciting to me too, because it seems like this is actually one of those models that fulfills one of the requirements. I was wondering if there actually are any at all. You know, what is the actual function of structure beyond a utilitarian standpoint of, oh, it's better than nothing? Like, that's disappointing to me. But yet this does seem to fit that bill because it links back to the breadth of storytelling, the breadth of narrative,
yeah,
which is the exact scope that it's prescribed to solve. So
when I remove it from existence and say, okay, this is not a thing, that is, to me, that is nihilism.
Yeah.
Like, you remove this meta-narrative, and you've sent the whole world spinning on its axis. I don't even think it's possible to exist that way, because I've never heard any creeds of absurdity. I mean, even the most absurd thing I've ever heard from Assassin's Creed, nothing is true, everything is permitted. Like, that in itself has baked underneath it a problem stated, solution proposed, final fulfillment.
Yeah, I think so.
So I don't know, but it's interesting. So back to the original question, now that we've kind of discretized this in
great men,
new levels,
yeah,
how do great men use this? It's not just individual.
It's not, and it's not as a reflection tool either. It's as a means of persuasion.
Yeah.
It's as a means of leading in that direct sense where people want to follow you.
Yeah.
And that is certainly a commonality between great men, is that that influence doesn't come just by being a loner. You know, you're not going to influence much like that. You
for
have
sure
to have many, many people following you to different degrees in order to actually cause this path of history to change in that unpredictable way.
Hmm. Yeah, and the problem stated must be a problem that is shared,
yes,
by many people.
Yeah.
The solution must fit that problem. You must show them how it fits that problem.
And they need to be involved in that solution somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are they going to do?
Right.
Yeah.
Actionable items. And then again, at that last step of...
It seems to be achievable.
A final fulfillment is something that is desirable for all who are following you.
Final enough.
Yeah.
You know, oh...
And sturdy. Yeah, that's right.
Like,
you know,
oh, you balanced the budget for the fiscal year of 2020.
Yeah.
We didn't spend more money than we took in. That's your goal? Okay, great. But most people don't care about that, even though
right,
that would be amazing.
Sure. It's not final enough, so it's not persuasive enough. That's right.
Yeah. And that's why we just have such, probably, in my opinion, a dearth of interesting politicians right now, because they're,
yeah,
problems... They're not like a greatest generation where it's like, problem stated, the evil axis
yeah, yeah,
of Germany and Japan. You know, that's obviously not the way we describe them all the time today, but there are definitely things they did that were evil. We try to view things historically unbiasedly, but at the same time, that's something that galvanizes the population. Civil rights, same
yeah
thing, even if you have problems with some of the communist methodology.
Or I'm even thinking more abstractly in terms of, you know, European societies, ancient European societies. You know, if you have a great influential king, their final fulfillment is going to be peace for a very long time. You know,
yeah,
that's something that everyone desires.
Yeah.
And sure, even if that solution proposed is difficult, you know, okay, I need all of your men to come to war with, you know, under my headship. It's difficult, but if that solution proposed is sufficient enough, it will happen.
Mm. It's really interesting stuff. So what I get from this is words must be used, specifically words that are persuasive. They're making use of the means of persuasion. And traveling as much as possible underneath this meta-narrative structure in a way that galvanizes people. I mean, think about it again. America in the Cold War, problem stated, communism will literally break the world.
Yeah.
Is what they believed.
Yeah.
And they had a solution to that, America. Merk, and a final fulfillment. So, what do you think happens when someone tries to negate this meta-narrative structure? What does that look like?
Chaos. It looks
can
like...
Can you discretize that chaos at all?
Perhaps. Go back to the example I gave about the book I read, and I used it as an analysis tool. His implementation of the means that he proposed in that book did not lead to his final fulfillment. It actually led to fracturing and splitting and just generally chaotic events happening, things that he didn't desire. When you don't follow a cohesive cognitive framework, meta-narrative, whatever you want to call it, you don't have an outcome. I don't think you even have an outcome that's predictable. I'll go so far as to say that. We don't know what happens. So it is intrinsically chaotic what happens when you have bad variables plugged into this formula.
I'm not even talking about bad variables. I'm talking, what if they negate the structure itself?
But as we already delineated, we're not sure
not
that that's
really possible.
Yeah. I don't think that that's really an option.
Yeah.
Which is why this is a satisfactorily broad tool. I think it's impossible to get around. Like, you do
I don't see it.
Absolutely
I
do
don't
it.
See
so.
The possibility of doing it. Well, what do you think our words to our audience needs to be on this? Because I don't want it to be simply, you know...
And maybe some of our listeners are sitting there wondering how we could possibly apply this to all narratives or something along those lines. Probably not quite understanding what we're saying. I think we are saying all narratives follow this structure, whether they want to or not.
Yeah.
And we're also saying it is not an oversimplification of the narratives to put it in this structure. How, just to try and clarify and wrap this point up, because we are trying to stay on the great man concept, although we keep going here to this tool.
Yeah.
How would you say, pick a complex narrative from a novel or something like that, actually is adequately represented, fully represented even, in this narrative structure? Is there branching of the narrative structure? Is there, you know, layers of it going on here? Is it a fractal? You know, what sort of
layers of it? But like we discussed earlier in one of our Sidelines episodes, you can kind of apply this to every character's individual life. There's a sweeping problem of the narrative. Like maybe you read a novel that takes place in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe you watch a movie, like the movie War Horse in World War I. And the horse has its own problems that it's facing.
Yeah.
The boys who were in the war have their own problems. Or a more recent one, 1917. The problem right out of the beginning is that the guy's brother is in a regiment that is sent into a death trap and they have to get to him to keep them from being killed.
Yeah.
And the final fulfillment is the brothers are reunited. If everything turns out the way it should. Every time I discretize this down, it's almost like the meta-narrative structure remains as the base currency.
Yeah.
To everything. The base thing that exchanges.
How low, what is the fundamental unit that you can fit into that structure? Because I'm thinking of it in recursive terms or in fractal
terms.
The
individual seems to be the lowest level.
Yeah.
And the broadest, sweepingest level seems to be the story as a whole.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anything below the individual, but there might be. That would be interesting.
I think that's about right. I think that's what came to my mind as well. So from the individual level in a story, and then you maybe have a group level, groups of groups, and on you go upwards to the overarching meta-narrative of that story, to kind of use the word loosely. At each level of analysis there, you have this tool adequately describing what's going on. I think that's right.
So great men... They're not born or made. They use tools, seems to be what we're saying.
It is unclear the means by which you become great, but at the very least, you have to influence great swaths of individuals, and you have to employ narrative in order to do that. In one way or another, you listen to any speech recorded, you will hear these elements if you're listening for them.
Absolutely.
This has been Narratives in Philosophy. I hope that you keep thinking these thoughts with us. We will continue on in our efforts as well. Consider what it is to be a great man. Perhaps pursue it, perhaps don't. Signing out.